with that, we're ready to proceed to the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar. And counsel, just take your time to settle into table and get yourselves organized. I'll ask the marshal to call the case for the record.
Case A19-0952, Jill M. Larson, appellant versus Wells Fargo Bank, and respondent.
And I'll just make a few brief remarks before you feel compelled to begin our conversation. So first of all, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I want to remind you to do a couple of things. First of all, make whatever adjustments you need to the lectern and the podium as you get up there to begin the conversation. Adjust the microphone, adjust the height, set out your materials. We look forward to hearing from you today. Before you begin your remarks, please remember to identify yourself for the record as well as the client that you represent. So with that, you can proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Drewis. D as in David, R-E-W-E-S as in Sam. I'm here representing appellant Jill Larson. Ms. Larson is with us here in the gallery today. We're here to talk about the validity of a foreclosure sale that happened on August 11 of 2017. I'd like to first take the court through this publication requirement, just the statute associated with that, then pivot to talking about the redemption periods, both the mortgagor redemption period and junior creditor redemption period under state law, the federal code, and then we'll talk about how those interact with the actual dates of the case. On the publication requirement, this was an August 11, 2017 sale. Leading up to that, there was a published notice of the sale. That notice can be seen as part of the addendum, page 11. There's no question as to what actually Wells Fargo did in that notice. That is an affidavit of the publisher themselves indicating what was published. The statute reads, each notice shall specify or contain the time allowed by law for redemption by the mortgagor. That's Minnesota Statute 580.04, subdivision A6. What is key is that it references that the time allowed by law for the redemption by the mortgagor, not some other random party. The mortgagor's redemption period is set forth by Minnesota Statute 580.23, subdivision 1A. That section reads, when lands have been sold in conformity with the preceding sections of this chapter, the mortgagor, the mortgagor's personal representatives or assigns, within 6 months after such sale, may redeem such lands. In this case, without any strange outside forces, 6 months would be the redemption period. The junior creditor redemption period is a different period. A junior creditor is allowed to redeem during a 1 week period following the mortgagor's period. So in other words, that statute is Minnesota Statute 580.24A. It reads, within 7 days after the expiration of the redemption period of the mortgagor. That's what...
So that's 7 days after the 6 months.
7 days after the 6 months.
And it would keep going if there were more junior...
Yes.
...creditors, right?
So okay. I think it helps to put that in context. So if you have a six-month redemption period and an August 11 sale, then you have a February 11, 2018, and a redemption period. You would then have a February 18 date would be the end of the redemption period for the junior creditor. Here we look at a federal code, 28 U.S.C. 2410.
And the reason we turn to that is because we don't have a junior creditor that's governed by the seven-day requirement, right? We have the U.S. government.
We have the U.S. government.
Different provision.
So if they're not the U.S. government, if it's not the USA, then they've got that seven-day period. And then the question before this court is, how does this federal statute impact that time period? Mm-hmm. The federal statute says, where a sale of real estate is made to satisfy a lien prior to that of the United States shall have 1 year from the date of sale within which to redeem. So here, it's interesting. Wells Fargo says, essentially, that because the United States is given a year to redeem, then they'll give the mortgagor, they'll give Jill Larson a year to redeem. But notice how that already doesn't line up. If you give Jill Larson a year to redeem, then you're giving the United States a year and 1 week to redeem. That already doesn't follow the federal statute because any junior creditor is allowed
additional
time.
Generally speaking, if you were a debtor, wouldn't you like more period to redeem than not?
You could balance those ideas. You could think about that. That's what one of the cases that we cite analyzed the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinions in American National Bank versus Blazer, where they analyze whether or not in that case, they're talking about whether or not a lender can just determine a 6-month or 12-month redemption period.
Isn't that the case where they were trying to avoid the deficiency judgment? I mean, it was quite a different scenario from what we have here, isn't it?
Oh, I don't see that at all. Because a deficiency judgment is at issue in this case. So Wells Fargo bid less than the total debt amount. We know that because you can compare Addendum 11 to Addendum 21. Addendum 11 is the published notice saying how much is owed. Addendum 21 is the actual bid at the sale, which was less. Now,
have they indicated they'll be seeking the deficiency?
No. In fact, I believe Wells Fargo has casually mentioned in their briefing that, you know, they're not seeking.
I don't know
deficiency.
That it's casually, counsel.
Oh,
I think they were pretty explicit, weren't they, in their brief? They're not going to pursue a deficiency judgment. That's what their brief said.
So they say.
Wasn't this a foreclosure by advertisement? I thought the only way you get a deficiency judgment is to foreclose by action.
Exactly.
They didn't foreclose by action, so they can't get a deficiency judgment.
Exactly. The advertisement statute says but hold on, Judge Warky. So it says that you can get a deficiency judgment if you foreclose by action with a 6-month redemption period. I'm sorry if I said that wrong. You cannot get a deficiency judgment if you foreclose by advertisement with a 6-month redemption period.
Right.
As soon as you have a 12-month redemption period, you're out of that statute, and you can seek a deficiency judgment.
The problem I see, and I feel like we're going down a rabbit hole, and I'm not sure it's all that necessary, given there is no deficiency judgment against Ms. Larson. But if we're going to go there, the deficiency judgment statute does link the protection from deficiency judgment to the actual time frame under Minnesota law that was applicable to Ms. Larson. It specifically references the statute, so it specifically references the 6-month time frame, doesn't it?
Yes, it specifically references the 6-month time period.
It doesn't link it to the notice, which is where the misstatement was. The misstatement is in the notice of foreclosure, not under the law.
Well, it's the notice of foreclosure, but then in the sheriff's certificate itself, again, addendum 20 to 21, that certificate of redemption says that Larson has a 6-month redemption period as well, or a 12-month redemption period as well. So for all practical purposes throughout this, Wells Fargo acted as if she had a 12-month redemption period.
But not under statute. Ms. Larson had a 6-month redemption period under the statute.
Yes, she
should.
Which,
as I said, the deficiency judgment statute links it over to what is her relevant redemption period under the statute.
So if they're foreclosing with the 12-month redemption period, then they can seek a deficiency judgment. If they're foreclosing with a 6-month redemption period, then they cannot. They should have sought a 6-month, therefore they should not be able to seek a deficiency. You're saying if they sue her now, which is the appropriate process after the fact, so if they were to sue her now and they have a number of years to do so, mm-hmm. seeking a deficiency judgment, at that argument, I think you're arguing that we could defend saying, well, it should have been a 6-month redemption period, and therefore even though it was a 12-month redemption period, we should be able to defend against this. At which point they could counter as well. They could counter saying, but it actually was a 12-month redemption period. I think it is key because here it would be, we know from the record it's over $1,000. We don't know the exact dollar amount of a deficiency judgment that they could claim. But with the affidavit of cost of the sale, it's about $2,000 more. It probably ends up being about $4,000 of a deficiency judgment that they could have pursued in this case.
Which they didn't, they're not going to.
Which they have not.
Okay.
I mean, they've stated in their brief that they have not. But if they're allowed to do this.
But I guess we can't trust them based on what happened in California.
Well, not just in California, Your Honor. I mean,
you know,
in this
you're
case
right,
itself,
nationwide.
They don't seem to follow, they don't follow the statute.
You know, Mr. Draws, do I pronounce that correctly?
Drewis.
So your rights are governed, well, first of all, do you agree that your rights are governed under 58.18, private right of action, which indicates the remedies that you get for violations of these foreclosure statutes?
58.18 is one of the basis for remedy.
Well, subdivision 1 states, a borrower injured by a violation of the standards, duties, prohibitions, or requirements of sections, and then it goes on to list all of them, shall have a private right of action and the court shall award, and it specifies as the courts can award all sorts of damages. What I'd like to know is, how are you injured?
Sure. I think there are two key points. Oh, I guess there's three key points there. One is what we were talking about before about the deficiency, which Wells Fargo says they're not pursuing. The other is this idea of bidders at a sale. Potential bidders could come to a sale. They would potentially bid on a property. If any potential bidder looks at this land that's about to be sold and goes to a real estate attorney and says, hey, should I bid on this? The advice that they receive is no, you shouldn't, because they're not complying with the Minnesota statute. They're not complying in this foreclosure by advertisement with the required sale amount. So in other words, those bidders are being deterred. When you look at—
Is there any indication in the record that any of those, that any bidders were deterred?
We don't know. That puts us in basically an impossible situation.
Well, is there any indication in the record that the, you know, the value of this property collapsed the longer it was on the market? Rather than going up, which, unless I'm confused, seems to have been the trend in the last couple of years in real estate. But is there any indication that where this property was located, no, it was just the opposite? You know, if you did, every day you delayed selling this, the value was going down $10,000. Is there anything like that in the record?
No, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that kind of a problem? I mean, speaking for myself and not the panel.
Well, let's step back and see what happens going forward. If the court does rule that the foreclosure sale is invalid itself, then we can go back and retake possession of the property. My client was evicted after. It's been abandoned for several months. My client at that point can say, look, let's compare the value of the property today versus the value of the property when I was, you know, undundeniably the owner. And let's, you know, and we'll see if there's injury there. Our argument on Chapter 58.
But that would be speculative, wouldn't it?
And counsel, the way I read that statute, you have to show an injury by the violation of the statute.
Yes.
So I hear you proposing all kinds of possible injuries from the violation of the statute, the deficiency judgment, possible, but apparently not. Bidders at the sale, possible, but you have no proof of it. And now you're talking about possible injuries if the foreclosure is voided. Well, I mean, sure. None of this gives you, I think, a claim under 518.18, does it? I mean,
well, let's look then at a violation of her rights. I mean, does she have a right to a legal foreclosure process? Does she have a right to have a foreclosure process that follows the law as opposed to one that does not follow the law?
I'm moving the question beyond whether there is a right, because I agree there is some language in 518. It's an earlier section. Is it 13 that gives very specific rights? But it's this claim that you're making for damages requires you to prove injury by the violation of the statute. And that's, I don't even see where you allege an injury from a violation of the statute.
Sure. So straight to that point, okay. I would say if you're saying that all the other issues are, or all the other examples are speculative, then I would point and say, well, she has certain rights within the statute itself, that the violation of the right itself is a violation of her rights. That is her injury. An injury is the taking away of her right to an accurate redemption period being listed in a foreclosure notice and an accurate redemption period within the sheriff's certificate. Separate from that, though, I don't want to confuse this from the invalidation of the foreclosure itself, right? We do talk about Chapter 58 in our initial primary, briefing in the district court. When we get to this court, our brief just asked for these issues to be remanded so that we could have a factual finding and continue to argue about facts associated with, is there an injury? So on appeal, we only ask that this be remanded on that point. On a separate issue entirely, you have the string of cases such as Jackson v. Mers and Ruiz, which say that that strict compliance is required and that a foreclosure is void regardless of prejudice, regardless of any of these other concerns. So our relief that we seek is on a statutory violation and separately and alternatively under Chapter 58. They're not complete.
For example, I see your complaint is alleging two different causes of action, if I understand you correctly. One is seeking to void the foreclosure sale, and the second is seeking damages under 518.18.
Yes, thank you.
Do I understand that right? Okay.
Yes. And so
you claim that all of this discussion that we just had about the no harm to Ms. Larson is irrelevant on your first claim. You say that you're entitled to have it voided based on the precedent set by Ruiz and Jackson.
Yes, okay. And so it sounds like the court is clear on our points there. As far as Chapter 58, we just ask that it be remanded so that those decisions can be made
I'd appreciate you have relatively little time left, so I'll leave you with a question, and feel free to, you know, summarize in a different way if you'd like, but something to address on your rebuttal would be, in terms of this court following Ruiz and Jackson, how do we square that with prior precedent? And they are old cases, admittedly, but cases relied on by Wells Fargo in its briefing to indicate that, well, not all inaccuracies in the notice of foreclosure are strictly enforced.
Great.
Some inaccuracies have happened in the past where the Supreme Court has decided not to void the foreclosure sale. And I appreciate that'll take you longer than 12 seconds to answer. So
I'll try. And the answer is that they strictly comply in all those instances. There's never a lack of strict compliance. Instead, those statutes pointed to and the cases referenced all focus on the statute and the language that says they don't have to state the actual amount due, they have to state the amount claimed due. And I'll address that further when I have more time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Charles Weber for the respondent, Wells Fargo. Your Honor, Judge Bradfield, let me just start with the question that you just posed, because there is an answer to that. And the answer is this. The distinction is that Ruiz and cases like that dealt with, and I'll just focus on Ruiz as sort of the example. Ruiz dealt with the requirements of Section 580.02, and it relied very heavily on the language of 580.02 as saying that this is a list of things in 580.02 that are required to entitle a lender to foreclose. And the Supreme Court was very insistent on the fact that when the statute says you have to do these things to be entitled to foreclose, you have to strictly comply with those requirements, all right? This case doesn't deal with Section 580.02. It deals with a different statute, 580.04, the notice requirement. And when we're dealing with statutory requirements other than 580.02, which governs the requisites to foreclose, courts apply a very different analysis. They apply the analysis that we've set out in Young against Penn Mutual, which we think is the case that governs here. Young against Penn Mutual was a case that involved the notice requirement of the foreclosure statutes, and it squarely held that an error, and we're not conceding this was an error in the notice, but even if it were an error in a notice does not void a foreclosure sale if it did not cause any injury, did not cause any harm. The distinction that I've just talked about is not one that we're just making up. It's actually one that the Eighth Circuit recognized, and I apologize, I don't think either side cited this case, but I wanted to just commend it to the court's attention. It's a case called Badrawi, B-A-D-R-A-W-I, against Wells Fargo, and that's at 718 F3rd 756. It's a 2013 decision from the Eighth Circuit that basically engaged in just the analysis I've suggested here. It distinguished Ruiz in that case because Ruiz dealt with the foreclosure requisites of 580.02, but Badrawi, like this case, involved a different statutory provision. And what the Eighth Circuit said was that Ruiz and cases of its ilk are strict compliance statutes that are reserved for the requisites of foreclosure, but not other statutes that touch on the foreclosure process. They're the different analysis.
Does the case you just cited, Badrawi, hope I'm saying it correctly, does it relate to notice of foreclosure by advertisement?
It does not. It dealt with a different statute that I believe, and I'm trying to go from recollection here, so I may be wrong, but I believe that it had to do with, it wasn't notice requirement. I think it had to do with notice sent to other parties who might have filed some sort of a notice of interest in the property. So it wasn't the foreclosure notice itself, but it was a different notice requirement.
And I appreciate you're drawing you're looking at the case law, trying to line up, why do we have different rules following down different lines? And if you would follow up your analysis of Young with a discussion of our decision in the Berkey case, where we did look at some of these prior precedents, and it appeared to me as though our court was trying to make sense of them, and said that, well, an amount claimed is potentially debatable, right? So if you have to give notice of the amount claimed in the notice of advertising by foreclosure, that might occasionally differ, right, as time goes on.
It could,
there could be
sure.
different perceptions of what the amount claimed is, because that right. sounds like an argument, like you're ready to make one. Whereas the requirement that is at issue here, this need to state the redemption period, no one disagrees about what Ms. Larson's redemption period was. Everyone agrees that Ms. Larson's redemption period was 6 months under Minnesota law.
Well,
so there's nothing to argue about or to be inaccurate about.
But there actually is, Your Honor, and it is this overlay with the federal statute, which is that we've got a federal statute that says that the United States was subject to a one-year redemption period, which left Wells Fargo with the dilemma, okay, what do we say in this notice? If we say that the redemption period for this property is 6 months, that absolutely has the potential to mislead potential bidders by saying, well, look, there's going to be a six-month redemption period after you sort of survive that period. You will be able to.
And I could see where you could persuade the legislature that that would be true. You could persuade the legislature that it is misleading on the notice of advertising foreclosure to say the mortgagor's redemption period is 6 months when, look at this, the U.S. government's involved and they're going to get their 1 year.
Yeah.
What I don't understand is how you pursue your preemption claim from 2410, because 2410 is only saying what the redemption period is for the United States. It doesn't purport to say what the redemption period is for a mortgagor.
Sure. Oh, quite right.
So how does it preempt Ms. Larson's redemption period?
Yeah, and
you are careful to not say that it does. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth.
Understand.
But it seems to me as though you are leading us along this path, and I don't see how we can embrace it.
Yeah, well, and it's certainly not direct preemption that we're arguing. Certainly that's true. The federal statute is not directly contrary to the Minnesota statute on the issue. What we've argued as far as preemption, though, is the sort of a conflict, a species of conflict preemption that the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have recognized, that says that when a state statute could pose an obstacle to achievement of congressional purposes, that's a form of preemption, even though it's not direct preemption. And as we pointed out, that problem actually exists here. Because with a state requirement that says, well, no, you have to, if the state requirement is you have to state only the borrower's redemption period and only that period under state law that's prescribed in the statute, well, now we've got a problem that we've got potential bidders out there believing that after 6 months, this property is going to be subject to, it's going to be past the redemption period, and it's going to be subject for them to take it and to rest secure in the fact that they have title of the property, when in fact, the federal government is out there with an additional at least 6 months to redeem the property. That's nowhere disclosed in the notice. And we've pointed out a scenario where confused purchasers of the property could create a very real problem for the United States by purchasing the property, perhaps conveying it to somebody else, thinking that they've got
happen.
Title to the property. What's that?
That didn't happen.
No.
Potentiality.
Here's what I was
focusing on. So Chapter 582 generally in mortgage foreclosures, the advertisement method of sale, 582.25 specifically lists every reason a mortgage foreclosure is valid against an objection. The objection such as, gee, I said the foreclosure was going to be on Tuesday and it was on Thursday. Does your position with this 1 year mortgage, the extension to the government, it would conceivably fall under any of the 25 enumerated reasons to validate a mortgage foreclosure? Could we conceivably fit it in anywhere?
Yeah, and Your Honor, I will confess that I don't remember the exact terms of that statute. I believe that there's some requirement that that there's the passage of time without a challenge. That may be a statute that says if a certain amount of time passes and there's no challenge, then these certain defects are deemed waived. And I believe that Ms. Larson filed her lawsuit before that time expired. I'm not sure on that, so I apologize if I've got that wrong, but I believe that there was an issue with her having sued just before that time period ran, so that the foreclosure is not incontestable, I guess is kind of a way to put it. We still have all of those arguments here under cases like Young.
I mean, it seems to me that there's so many of these provisions are even less than what happened here. I mean, you could conceivably have the wrong legal description and wrong county, wrong state, and it still can survive.
Yeah, and I think that's a kind of a safe harbor provision that basically said after passage of enough time, yes, errors that are even worse than the alleged error here absolutely do survive after the passage of time. But that's not to say, I don't believe that that statute is saying these are the exclusive defects in the notice provision or other provisions of the foreclosure process that can essentially be cured and that everything else is subject to a strict compliance standard. I don't believe that that's what that statute says, and I don't think the courts have read it that way. I think that statute, if I'm recalling it correctly, establishes sort of a safe harbor, but the failure to qualify for the safe harbor doesn't mean that you are, I don't know what the opposite of a safe harbor is, in an unsafe harbor, I guess. It doesn't mean that you automatically lose. It just means that you have to talk about cases like Young against Penn Mutual and all the other cases that we're discussing here.
Mr. Weber, I had one question. You know, in terms of strict compliance with the notice, and we've discussed, you know, maybe the amount of claim can have problems, maybe the legal description, the date of the sale, but wouldn't the one thing more than anything else we would want to get right is letting the debtor know precisely how much time they have to redeem? Because that's, you know, that's the gun to the head, okay? You know, if I don't come up with the money in X months, I'm out of here forever. Mm-hmm. And isn't that something we really would want more than anything else for the banks to get right?
Yeah, and that may be, and just taking that, you know, sort of spotting Your Honor that, we've got that here because we have said we extended the 12-month redemption period to Ms. Larson if she had chosen to avail herself of it. Now, of course, she didn't. There was no evidence in the record that she came to us at 11 months and, you know, 25 days and said, here's the money I'd like to redeem. And we said, oh, no, sorry. I know that the notice said 1 year, but really you only had 6 months. We absolutely would have extended this redemption period to her as well. And as Your Honor pointed out in conversation with my friend on the other side, that's a benefit to her. It would be a benefit to her to give her more time to come up with the funds necessary to redeem the property. We were perfectly willing to do that. So there's no claim here.
Provided that interest rates aren't going up.
Well, even if interest rates had gone up, that was something that we were willing to extend to her.
How do you respond to counsel's argument saying that under Minnesota law you're not allowed to extend Ms. Larson's redemption?
Yeah, I don't think that's...
I realize the facts of that particular case, yeah. The name's escaping me right now, but the facts of that particular case are very different from what's happening here because that lender was actually trying to do a runaround and get a deficiency judgment.
Yeah.
So terribly different facts. But I think the language of the decision is pretty clear that you don't have the ability. Wells Fargo has no ability to extend Ms. Larson's redemption period.
I don't think that's a fair implication of the case because I think a lender could always say to the borrower, look, you want to redeem even though the 6 months has passed? That's fine. Come on in. We'll let you do that. Now, there's some risk, obviously.
Particularly if you couldn't unload the property.
If
you could not unload the property to someone else.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. But now that may come at some risk if, you know, there were other junior creditors out there that had a period. But assuming that it's just a straight up, the borrower is the only person with an interest, sure, a lender could say, we're going to give you some extra time to redeem the property just because they feel they just want to do it that way. So I think that what that case prohibited was what we had stated in our brief, is trying to play games with the deficiency period and say, well, we're going to pretend that it's a 12-month period and chase a deficiency. And just to make it absolutely clear, I think the court is clear that we've been clear. We have not and will not pursue a deficiency judgment. I'm saying that right here. That's a representation to the court from my client. So I think that the
no
the,
fool you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right, exactly right. So that's just not going to happen, and I think that's off the table, which I think then effectively distinguishes that other the case that the counsel is citing, where you did have a lender that was actually trying to play games with it. That's not our intent at all. What we had here was a dilemma, as I said. We've got a state statute that seemed to say we need to say 6 months, a federal statute that said there's one creditor that gets 12, and the question is, okay, how best are we going to handle that?
So there's always a discrepancy, though, counsel,
yeah.
Right?
Sure.
There was the mortgagor's redemption period of, in this case, 6 months. The junior creditors always get 7 days additional. So there's always some uncertainty, isn't there?
There is a little bit, and some of that is prescribed by law, obviously, to some
supposedly
extent.
Supposedly, buyers are careful about that, do title searches, and have other mechanisms for determining if there are other claims potentially pending out there before they lock up an offer or
yeah.
actually close on it.
No, and I have to agree that, you know, shame on a creditor that didn't understand so necessarily its
rights. I'm just not persuaded
rights.
That this obstacle preemption analysis that you're making really carries the day when our foreclosure statutes already foresee a series of redemption periods, not a single redemption
period. Yeah, well, and I think it is different, though, Your Honor, just because I think that creditors or potential bidders are very used to the fact that state redemption period schemes like Minnesota's do have this feature where there's sort of a staging, right? The debtor gets a certain amount of time, and then junior creditors get that amount of time plus a little bit more and then plus a little bit more kind of on down the line. The federal statute is a little bit of a surprise. That doesn't come up all that often. And I think that particular redemption period is much more likely to come as a surprise to potential bidders than the fact that junior creditors on the title, sort of conventional second mortgagees or third mortgagees, would have a little bit of extra time to exercise their rights. I think potential bidders are used to that kind of thing because, you know, they themselves sometimes are the junior creditors. But I think the federal statute is a little bit of a surprise here, and I think that that's why we had more of a dilemma than we usually would in the usual case where you've got just a garden variety second mortgagee or third mortgagee. That was sort of the dilemma that we faced, and there's been no argument that anybody was confused by it. Like I said, Ms. Larson got the advantage of a longer redemption period, and I think under the cases like Young against Penn Mutual, which we think is just right on here, it's never been overruled, it's never been questioned, and it's easily explained what the distinction is between cases like Young against Penn Mutual. In cases like Ruiz, it's the argument that they're the, if I could just finish this, just the sentence, it's the observation that the Eighth Circuit made in Bedrawi and that what we have submitted here, that it is simply a difference between the language of the statute that spells the difference between treatment. 580.02 is governed by a very strict compliance standard. Other foreclosure-related requirements are not, and that's what we're dealing with here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. On this issue of strict compliance that we were just talking about, this court has already ruled on these issues. In Hunter versus Anchor Bank, this court, in a published opinion, said, the Supreme Court's recent opinions on Chapter 580 indicate that a failure to strictly comply with any statute in Chapter 580 causes a foreclosure to be void. That's unambiguous, straightforward, published work of this court. How do you compare that, or how do you address this young
Lico Burke? So did Hunter somehow implicitly overrule the line of cases beginning with Young and including, there are several of them.
Young, Lico, and Burke? No, not at all. Because in those cases, they're specifically identifying, and Your Honor actually addressed this, I believe, that in Statute 580.04A3, now that's the section that says that a creditor, that a foreclosing party, when publishing this notice, they must include the amount claimed to be owed at the time of the publication. That statute itself opens the door for what claim to be. As long as the creditor says, I claim $100,000 is owed, or I claim $169,000 is owed, or I claim a dollar amount is owed, well, that is literally complying with whatever they claim it is owed. So in those cases, you can look and see that there's no violation of the statute. Instead, the arguments in those cases are, look, let's have a rubric for if we think fraud is being committed by a party that's claiming an amount that's clearly fraudulent or clearly wrong. Instead, in those cases, the court decided if the creditor is claiming an amount owed, then so be it. They've met the statutory burden because they've set that amount. If you look at the statute that we address here, 580.04A6, there's no it doesn't say that Wells Fargo must publish a notice of a redemption period claimed to be by Wells Fargo. It says it must, it says the actual redemption period. On this idea of strict compliance, I mean, you can go back further a bit and look at Jackson. I mean, I could go ad nauseum about Jackson, but it says, because foreclosure by advertisement is a purely statutory creation, the statutes are strictly construed. When we strictly construe these statutes, we see that simply the statute wasn't followed. Judge Warkey raised the issue of 582.25. This is often referred to as the Curative Act. It addresses what happens to foreclosures after defects existed, but after a period of time. In the preamble of that statute, you'll see that it talks about how the following instances involve sales, and the quote is, they are legalized and made valid. I believe that's the quote from the initial preamble of that. You legalize and make valid these sales because otherwise they are illegal and void. It's I think it's called reverse inference preemption or something like that. I don't recall, but this was specifically argued and addressed in the Ruiz decision. The Supreme Court in Ruiz analyzed that. They analyzed these sort of arguments and rejected them. In response to issues about this claim of deficiency judgment, we've heard Wells Fargo is not going to pursue a deficiency judgment here. But this case stands for a larger proposition, right? If Wells Fargo succeeds here in determining, yes, when there's an SBA loan, when there's an IRS lien, when there's a HUD lien such as this one, when there's another lien on the property, we get to have a 12-month redemption period instead of what otherwise would be a 6-month redemption period, then they get to pursue that deficiency judgment. Again, the deficiency statute literally reads, a deficiency judgment is not allowed if a mortgage is foreclosed by advertisement under Chapter 580 and has a redemption period of 6 months under Section 580.23, Subdivision 1, or 5 weeks under this other section. So it's only if it's that 6-month redemption period. So if Wells Fargo is given the pass on this, then over this $4,000 amount, which they say they're not collecting after the fact, by the way, after the lawsuit, they step forward and say, oh, by the way, we're not going to collect that after we bring this lawsuit, then what happens the next time or the time after that when it's $40,000 or $400,000 or some other dollar amount? They're seeking to open the door. The last point is when we step back and look at public policy concerns and why we have all these statutes in the first place, this was Jill Larson's homestead, and Minnesota public policy strongly encourages that homeowners should be entitled to their homes. Even at the sacrifice of just demands, the Minnesota Supreme Court said in 2013, even at the sacrifice of just demands to ensure a stable and independent citizenry and thereby promote the public welfare, it has always been the policy of the law to protect with jealous zeal the homestead right of the citizen. That's Marine Credit Union versus Detlefsen Delano, cited in our brief. Thank you.
So our thanks to counsel for your arguments today. We very much appreciate them. The matter is now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So our thanks to counsel again. With that, we have completed the four matters on our oral argument calendar, and we will now be in recess for our non-oral.